The Mac Observer's Mac Geek App, episode 704 for Monday, April 9th, 2018.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek App. The show where we take your questions, your tips, your cool stuff found, mix it all together, answer your questions, share your tips, share your cool stuff found. The goal is that every single one of us learns at least five new things every week when we get together. Each and every week when we get together, that is. Sponsors for this episode include Barebones Software. BBEdit 12.1 is out, and it definitely still does not suck. We'll talk more about why that is in a moment. But here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, mixing up a tasty Mac stew.
Tasty Mac stew. I like it.
This is John F. Braun.
How are you doing today, Mr. John F. Braun?
I'm telling you, making a stew, man. Look forward to it after we're done.
That's good. Cool.
No.
Yum.
Not really.
Oh, you should be, though. It seems like one of those days. I don't know. It's like sunny, but a little cold. Yeah. Let's just jump right into it. We have a cool stuff found, a few cool stuff found, cool stuffs found for you, including our first, which comes to us courtesy of Craig from the last show, number 703, where he says, I just finished listening and thought I would pass on an answer to the Geek Challenge regarding geotagging photos. I often need to geotag photos taken with my DSLR camera that doesn't have geotagging capacity. I have been using Huda Geo, H-O-U-D-A-H, G-E-O, and found it quite powerful. It works with individual files as well as photos from within the Photos app. You can search for locations, use a map, or even use a reference photo that does have GPS info. A feature I find very handy. I will often have also taken a photo from my iPhone at the same location or close by that I can use as a reference photo for Huda Geo to take the GPS coordinates from. I know that you can add location info to photos inside the Photos app, of course, but from what I have read, doing it that way does not update the EXIF tags, but stores it as photo data in the Photos app, much like tags, and so may not go with the photo if you export it or use it elsewhere. Awesome. Thank you so much, Craig. That's great. And yeah, it's possible. This is the first time we've mentioned Huda on the show, and that kind of surprises me, that it's been 13 years, but I don't think we've ever mentioned. So they make Huda Geo, which of course we just talked about, and then Huda Spot, that's useful for like finding files better than the Finder's search, and they've got all kinds of things. So anyway, I'm glad to be mentioning their stuff. Thank you, Craig. Actually, thank you, everybody. There were a few handfuls of you that suggested Huda Geo. So thanks for that.
That's fun to say. Huda.
Huda. All right. Moving on. Anything on that, John, before I move us?
No, it disappoints me that Apple's kind of drawing outside of the lines.
Yeah, it's not surprising. I mean, I've seen that, but it's not always that way with photo. Like, I've seen photos add EXIF data. At least I thought it did, but maybe I'm wrong. Seth brings us to, I will find it here. Seth writes, I've always had mixed results trying to get workflows or apps to run on a schedule using the calendar app. Sometimes they run, sometimes they don't. I recently came upon an app called Launch D Task Scheduler in the App Store for $3.99 US. It has a simple GUI right to the point, choose the app or workflow and schedule and done. The app runs when it is supposed to run every single time. And I've put a link to that, of course, in the show notes. Launch D is like the thing that the system uses to kick off all sorts of events and things like that. So tapping directly into it is by far going to be the best way. I've always used something called Lingon, and we've talked about that on the show a few times, but for this particular purpose, having this purpose-built app, it certainly is easier than digging through Lingon's more complex and more featured interface. But again, for that one sole purpose of scheduling things, Launch D Task Scheduler looks pretty good. So thank you for that, Seth. Anything on that, John?
Yeah. And I mean, if you want to dive into it, I think what it's really doing, so I think you have two or three different folders scattered about. So I think launch agents, startup items, and I think there's one other.
Well,
actually what?
Yeah. So in your library, your home library folder, you have launch agents and maybe launch daemons that may or may not be there. But you also have those same two folders in just the main library folder above your user folder. But I think what this app does is it puts it in your home library launch agents folder, which would make sense because that's where those things go.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Because crafting those by hand is crazy talk.
Well, I mean, it's just a plist file, an XML file. Mm-hmm. What I recommend actually, if you know, because it's always good to learn kind of how things work behind the scenes. A, because it's fun, but also B, gives you a little bit of foundation for when you have a problem. But I would say get something like this LaunchD Task Scheduler, create your schedule, and then go into that home library launch agents folder and look at the thing you just made, and then you can see like what it's doing and how you would craft something like this, and that could be interesting. So, that's what I think. Well, I don't know.
I concur.
Sweet. Listener Norton brings us what I call a cool stuff found reprise, but it's possible this one has been reprised before. It may be the most reprised cool stuff found, which is really interesting and perhaps telling, but he says Reset Plug by Multinet is the most valuable and useful product I have used on my Wi-Fi network. Before I installed it, my router would stop working several times a week, and I would have to run downstairs to turn it off and on to reset it. No more. Reset Plug does the work perfectly, and my Fios network springs to life after a minute or two. So this, you can find this at resetplug.com. And what it does is it's just a plug that you plug into the wall, and then you plug your router into this. And it acts. You connect it via Wi-Fi to your router, and it constantly tests the internet connection. And if the internet connection fails, then Reset Plug will cycle the power on whatever's plugged into it, which should be your router. And then, boom, you reset your internet connection. But here's the thing. And like I said, many of you have suggested this in the past, which indicates that there is a problem with routers, and we've seen this not so much lately, at least not with the current crop of routers that are out there, but back in the kind of 802.11g days, I seem to remember things needing to be rebooted regularly. But if your router is dying several times a week and needs to be rebooted, like I feel like, especially he says it's, you know, it's his Fios network. Like that equipment's owned by Verizon and you're renting it from them, I think. And you should go to them and tell them, you need to get me something to replace this. Cause it shouldn't be dying three times a week. Like I get that the Reset Plug is a good thing and, you know, can save your bacon because if your wife or if your router goes haywire, then you've got nothing. And you can't get into your network from the outside because your router's gone haywire. So I like it. But I still kind of feel like this is not necessarily a good thing. Like there's a deeper problem here. Right?
I like the bacon part of what you just said.
Okay. Well, there you go. I'm glad.
But I think I had, I'm with you, though, is that ages ago, I think it was one of their misses, but I think it was a mono-price Wi-Fi base station that...
Yeah, you did. You had something like that for a short time.
No, it would just, after a couple of days, it would just roll over and, it was one of their misses. Currently, every product I've gotten from them has been stellar.
That's not been the case for me. Like I said, that monitor that I bought a year ago doesn't want to wake up with the Mac. They think that it's actually, I'll bring it up, but they think it's the data path across the display port is only 8 bits, I think, with this one, and the other one's 10 bits, and so it can read Ooh. That data. Like, the one I have downstairs is 10 bits, and so it does better syncing up when the machine wakes up and getting those messages across. Hmm. Yeah, I think, that's the only difference, hardware difference, between those two things, and they said, yeah, that's probably it. So, I don't know. It's a weird thing. Let's see. Well, I had something to add to that, but I don't think. Oh, yeah, I am speaking this weekend. And for anybody in the Philadelphia area, I am speaking at the ML Mug, or the Mainline Mug, just outside of Philly on Saturday morning. So anybody listening that is in that area, I believe they are. I know they're good people. And I believe that anyone can attend. So I think things start at like 9:30 or something. I'm going to be talking about running your, I think we're calling it running your Mac and iPhone lean, clean, and mean. So we'll go through some things that you can do to make sure your stuff's running at peak efficiency and peak performance. Yeah.
Isn't our pal Chuck out there somewhere?
Chuck is out there somewhere. Yeah, I think that's right. Chuck Joyner. So yeah. So Mainline Mug, MLMUG. I think it's MLMUG.org. And so I'll put that in the show notes. Nice. Yeah.
Just don't be too mean.
Oh, no, no. They're good people. I spoke with them last year. They're good. I liked them. So, okay. While we're on the subject of good people, I would like to thank our premium subscribers whose contributions came in this week. In the biannual $25 every 6 month plan, we have Paul K, Ralph F, David C, Chris H, Kurt T, Garrett N, Bob H, James N, all at 25. And then in the biannual plan on the choose your own contribution amount, we have both Dominic D and Lawrence H came in at 50 each. So thanks to all of you. You are awesome. We then have Abdullah B on the monthly $10 plan, along with Paul M, Mike C, Mark R, Dave C, Frank A, Working Smarter for Mac Users, a.k.a. Dr. Mac, Neil L, Scott F, John G, and Barry F. And then we had a one-time contribution of $120 from Mr. Brian H. So thanks to all of you. You make it possible for us to do what we do here. So thanks so much. It means a lot. It really does. I know I say that every week. But we mean it. You know what I mean, John?
It's certainly a motivation.
It is a motivation. There you go. Hey, you know, we've talked in the last two episodes about that dialogue that comes up asking you for what appears to be your iCloud password, which could also be iMessage or FaceTime or any one of those things. And we've talked about how someone could, in theory, dig in and create one of those that operated in a nefarious way to capture your iCloud password. Well, listener Jeff comes up with perhaps the perfect period to put on this this particular sentence or this paragraph. He says in episode 702, Dave was adamant that the Apple ID dialog box was trustworthy. Not always, Jeff says correctly. Clever app developers in the past have been able to spoof this. There is a very simple way for any user to test whether the dialog box is real. When the dialog box appears, just press the home button, or on an iPhone 10, swipe up from the bottom. A real Apple ID dialog box message is an iOS system message and cannot be cleared by pressing the home button or swiping up. If the dialog box is presented by an app, pressing the home button or swiping up will close the app and the phishing dialog box along with it. These phishing apps are usually caught by Apple before being posted on the App Store. However, peers in China and Europe have seen this attack on iOS devices until Apple pulled the responsible apps. Thank you, Jeff. That's perfect. When you see it, press the home button. If it's still there, type in your password. There's our advice. Simple, to the point, and most importantly, accurate. So thanks, Jeff. Good stuff, huh, man?
Nice.
Yeah, I think so. All right, let's get into something a little geeky here. Graham has a great little tip for us here. Graham writes, In my accounting software, when I tell it to email out an invoice, it creates a pre-formatted message and passes it on to the Apple Mail app for immediate sending. However, because I'm running old software, which doesn't properly integrate with current versions of macOS, it fails to attach the PDF of the invoice. So I need to prevent Mail from actually sending the message until I manually attach the PDF. I'm not 100% confident that telling Mail to put my accounts into offline status will prevent this. I don't think it will. So you're good to not have confidence in that. He says, so I have created a rule in Little Snitch that blocks outgoing connections from the Mail app. Normally the rule is deactivated, but when I'm doing my invoicing, I activate this rule in Little Snitch and it causes the generated emails to end up in the drafts folder. Hence, I can be absolutely confident that I have a chance to amend and review the outgoing emails as required. Once reviewed, I deactivate the Little Snitch rule and send the draft message from Mail. This, he says, prevents me from sending attachment-less emails. And hence, he says, I don't get caught. So I like that. And I'm sure his Little Snitch rule just stops Mail from talking, right? That would be the simplest way to do that. I like that. That's good. There are workarounds, potentially. Mail Acton has outbox rules, which can be applied by default or by a rule. So you could have it automatically hold those messages for, say, 30 minutes or something, where you could go in and edit them with Mail Acton. The other thing that I've created with Mail Acton is a rule that says if I mention the word attach in an email, but there is no attachment, stop me and throw up a dialog box before letting me send that email off. And perhaps that would be doable with what Graham's talking about here, something that says, look, if it's your accounting software, you know, some line of text or some other thing that's consistent to all these emails, just if it has that in it, throw up a dialog so that you can go and add the attachment. So maybe it's worth checking out. Do you use anything like that, John? Like Mail Acton or anything like that?
No? Nope.
Okay.
But it's a nice rule. I mean, I like that Mail, last I checked, if you try to send a message without anything in the subject line, it's like, dude.
Yeah, exactly.
You're sending an email with this blank. It'd be nice if Mail would reliably let you do other conditions. But my Little Snitch is my pal.
Yeah, Little Snitch is very powerful. I mean, I've talked about how I use it when I travel to limit the things that my computer tries to do when in a hotel room. And it works really well at that, because I have it at home. I just, like, when it's on my home Wi-Fi network, I have a profile set. Everything just runs wide open, so it's not pestering me all the time. But when I get to a hotel, I've got this set of rules that just limits some of my background apps. It doesn't try to do backups and things like that that might, you know, slow things down. It works well. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm tickled by the ability of finding out who's trying to phone home.
Mm.
I mean, sure. Especially with OS updates, it's interesting in that Apple will add new processes create new processes. But, you know, having it come up saying, oh, yeah, this, you know, new daemon is or daemon, however you want to call it.
I said daemon before. Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Demon, whatever, but
D-A-E-M-O-N is how this word is pronounced, and there are holy wars fought online about, or that's how it's spelled. There are holy wars fought online about how it's pronounced. So if you want to get into that, like, it's awesome. Just make sure if you're going to write a reply on one of those that you use VI because Emacs sucks. So there you go.
You beat me to it. I was an Emacs guy.
I know.
Emacs, that's the other champion.
That's the other holy war. You folks think that Mac and Windows holy wars online were reached epic proportions. I think nothing that will ever come close to the VI versus Emacs debate that still rages on.
But I'll concur that Emacs is the kitchen sink of editors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what a lot of people don't like. I don't like VI or Emacs. I use Nano. So they.
Oh.
Yes.
What did I use last for? I think I used Pico. Pico is another one, right?
Pico is like Nano. Yeah.
No. I'm hardcore, man. Ed.
Oh.
I don't even know if you can call it an editor. I mean, it has the words ED in it, right?
Yeah, I don't know, man. It's pretty bare bones. It's pretty bare bones. But, you know, it works. Mm-hmm. It works. It works. In the chat room, I wanted to highlight, Brother Jay said that MailMate, which is a third-party mail application from Freron Software, it's actually, I don't know that I've ever heard of this. He says that it has an attach keyword setting to halt outgoing messages as well. So it can do this. This looks like an interesting mail client. It's, I mean, I'm just looking at the feature list. I can't see any screenshots or anything, but it says it supports OpenPGP and SMIME and all that stuff. So yeah, interesting. I don't know.
And of course, if you want to join the peanut gallery, which I say in the most positive way possible,
sure,
you can go to macgeekgab.com/stream. I think that's where it still is, right?
Is it stream? Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, that's where it is. There you go. And Brother Jay says that MailMate is strictly for power users. So that's interesting. I'm putting it on the list. I'm going to check it out. Good stuff. All right. Chris chimes in with a helpful little tip for anyone that uses an old connected data transporter. He said, I was generating lots of heat from the top of my head trying to work out why I no longer had access to my transporter library after upgrading to High Sierra and feared that all the long-term storage I had placed there was gone. The files were still available on the connected data website, but he says this would have taken involved a lot of downloading and repositioning files to a new storage medium. Not fun. I'm aware that this is a storage system I should not rely on going forward, but Nexan has released a fix for those in the same position as me. And sure enough, there's a little High Sierra patch that we will link to, of course. And he says, I hope it helps someone else out there. So thanks for sharing that, Chris. That's great. Again, we'll put that in the show notes. But Chris is right. If you're still using the transporter, I would, I mean, there, I think support for it is, well, support for it's officially done, but, and there are other products that Nexan sells use the same online system. So I think the online portion of it, the syncing portion of it should work for a while, but I wouldn't rely on it. I'd move on to something else that's actually going to, you know, routinely see support updates and that sort of thing. You never know which update from Nexan is going to be the last for the transporter. So, but kudos to them for getting this one out. It's good. Anything on that, John?
My transporter kind of rolled over and died. So,
oh, there you go. Yeah, mine still works. I still have it running on the network, and I think I have Pete's transporter here with an external hard drive hanging off of it.
Interesting.
Yes. Yes. All right. Tad asks a question. He says, Dave, you seem pretty pumped up about using Stringify. I looked into it and downloaded the app, and it seems pretty powerful. But with all the account hacking and breaches going on these days, I was leery to sign up. Since the app is free, how are the developers making their money? Where does this fall on the privacy slash usefulness scale for you? So this is a good question. Just as a quick reminder to catch everybody up, Stringify is an app very similar to Ift, where you can use, it's an iOS app, but it's also a service where you can set home automation type or automation. It works with home automation, but you can do other things too. You can set triggers to kick off events. And if you've used Ift, Stringify is the same, but more powerful. But this is a good question. And of course, the same thing applies to Ift as well as Stringify, right? That, or any other service that needs or wants access to your other accounts. The way these work, is you say, okay, I'm going to log Stringify into my Ring doorbell account. Great. Now I can get some triggers from that, or I can push some changes to that depending on how, you know, what the API supports. And then I want to log Stringify into my Hue Lightbulbs account. And again, same thing, like it can either give me some triggers or allow me to pass some commands. And then you can use Stringify as the thing that wires these two separate systems together so that when there's a, you know, I keep talking about it, where there's a signal from my Ring that says there's motion in the driveway, I want to turn on my Hue lights. And Stringify works great to do that. So the question is, what happens there if somebody breaks into my Stringify account? You know, what can they do? Because now, in theory, you've got access to my Ring account and my Hue account. And that's true in terms of you have access to the API that Stringify has access to. It doesn't store my password or anything. It's just doing authentic, like OAuth, open authentication. But still, you've got access to the API. So you could know when someone's in my driveway, when someone's on my back porch, when someone's at my front door. You can't see the videos because that's not accessible via Ring's API, so I'm not worried about that. You could turn on my lights, and that same is true with my Hue lights. You could turn those on too. So I'm not that worried. I'm a geek. I like to, you know, I'd rather have the toys and play with them than worry too much about security in this regard. But any cameras that I have inside my house are not linked to a cloud service. They link directly to my Synology, and I use Surveillance Station on that. Right. And
okay.
And that way, you know, that never leaves my house. And actually, at the moment, I only have one camera in the house. Actually, it's a cool camera. It's a Foscam camera that has a it's got motors in it, so I can like swivel it and pivot it and everything. It's great. But that only talks to Surveillance Station on my disk station right now on my Synology. And I don't even have it recording video. It's just like I can view the camera and control the camera through Surveillance Station, but it's not saving anything, which is how I want it. Yeah. So, you know,
so what you're trying to say, so if I somehow figured out how to hack your Stringify account, which would then give me access to other things. So you're saying I couldn't, for example, Ring, which we both have, and, you know, think they're pretty neat. Like with my Ring, I can see, you know, you can do a live stream of what's happening around the Ring.
Correct.
You're saying I couldn't do that?
Not via Stringify, because that's not available through the API.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But if it was, you could, you know, and someday it might be, right? And I won't get a warning from, maybe I would get a warning from Ring saying, hey, you know, we've chosen to open up the live streams on, you know, our API, and here's all these apps that you've already wired up to it. Just make sure you want those to have access to that. I don't know if Ring would do that or not. Right, but they could. Yeah. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Not that I'm worried about that.
No,
because
they're pictures of the outside. They're from house out. Like the house is the only thing you can't see in the Ring camera. And I'm okay with that. I mean, I guess if I want to run
and both of my cameras are
something.
Well, one of my cameras is looking at my backyard and the other one on the Ring is looking at a public street. So, you know, so what if somebody could see that?
Right. That's kind of how I feel about it. Now, I mean, it could be argued that, well, if somebody can see that, they can figure out your address. And if they can figure out your address and, you know, all that stuff. Well, yes, that's totally true. For me, there are other ways to figure out my address that are way easier than trying to hack into my Stringify account. Like, for example, simply looking up, you know, my name in the town that I that I mention at the beginning of every episode for 13 years. Like that particular ship has sailed for me. People know where I live. So if you wanted to, you could probably figure out how much my house is worth. I mean, like all that stuff, like you just go nuts. And you know, if that kind of thing floats your boat, then that's what you'll do. And maybe you've already done it and that's okay. Like I get it. I'm sort of the same way. So,
you know, I actually have to look into that because, as you know, I'm sure you're aware, as our listeners, that, you know, I recently switched my phone service from AT&T, which switched over to Frontier.
Yeah.
And I was in their directory, and then I switched over to Optimum. And as far as I know, they offered to put me in, I think, their directory versus what we'll call the phone book.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, you search for my name and my town, and you'll probably find my address. And if you want to stop by, that's cool.
That's
you know,
cool, right.
Just to,
yeah.
I'll just have to, you know, check you out with my ring
right
before I let you in or, yeah. or you know call the authorities
yeah your address as mine is published on the internet. I found yours on benverified.com just doing a Google search for exactly the same thing that you just said. Mm-hmm. Your name and your town, so there you go. Yeah. And I've got Warren in the chat room saying, Dave, I'm on your lawn naked waving at you. That's awesome. Unfortunately, I'm podcasting, so I just can't pull it up. But, you know, whatever. It's fine. I'm sorry to miss out.
Kind of cool to be naked, I think.
It's awfully cold out there to be naked. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, moving on to Colby. Please save us, Colby. Colby writes, I have a 15-inch MacBook Pro from mid-2015, lots of 15s, running the latest version of macOS High Sierra. The past few times I have tried to run updates from the Updates tab in the Mac App Store, I've been running into an interesting issue. It just loads a blank screen with the copyright text and that stuff at the bottom. I try to refresh, but nothing changes. All the other tabs for the Mac App Store, such as Features and Purchased, load as they normally would. However, if I try to open the Updates tab, the white screen with no options or even the update history shows again. I tried running the maintenance automation in Onyx to no avail. I tried reinstalling macOS using the macOS Utilities Reinstall macOS feature. This, however, resulted in the same blank screen. I find this interesting as the Apple menu states that I have 6 updates available. However, I don't seem to be able to access them at all. Do either of y'all guys or other listeners know what could be causing this issue? I've seen this before, albeit not with the persistence that you're seeing there, Colby. I can't remember if it was a reboot or it was either a reboot or maybe a reboot into safe mode that solved it for me. I'm not convinced that's going to solve it for you, but I feel like it's worth trying. Safe mode is done by holding the shift key down on startup. And we can put a link in the show notes that explains that in more detail. But that's basically it, is hold down the shift key until you see it say safe mode and then you're good to go. This could, and perhaps more likely, be caused by a corrupt Mac App Store cache. And I don't know if Onyx addresses those. I don't think it does.
It does not.
It does not. Okay, there you go.
But I'll tell you who does.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I remember, we referred to this article in the past, but we'll refer to it again here. But I just found it here. So I was thinking the same as you.
Yeah.
And I actually searched for App Store caches. And there's a dandy little article on Stack Exchange called How to Fix / Reset App Store App on Mac OS X.
Okay.
Now, it says for El Capitan, but there is the gist of this article is that you go to your home directory, library, caches, and then there's com.apple.appstore.
Okay.
And apparently, that contains the cache file. So those, as we know, cache files, and it gives some further instructions here. But I think that's the gist of it. So as we all know, caches can get corrupt. So, and I think I've had to do this one. Not lately. I've been pretty lucky with my App Store experience.
Huh. Yeah. And Warren in the chat room, I guess he put his pants back on, says, I've seen it too. Sometimes your clock being off causes it. So there you go.
Really?
Yeah. But wow. You know, I mean, who knows? It's a web view, right? So it just starts getting wonky. It's just how that stuff is. It's kind of, I think they do it similar to how iTunes Store works too. So.
And let's see. And you found that.
No, I didn't find it. I put a different one in the show notes. I found one that also on Stack Exchange, but it talks about doing killing off 4 processes, store account D, store asset D, store download D, and store in app D, and then deleting the caches specific to those four processes and then restarting the App Store. So we'll put them both out there because either one is good to try. So good stuff, I think. Let's go to listener Dave here. And listener Dave asks, let me drop a timestamp. Otherwise, nobody will know where we are. I have a question about drives. I've got a mid-2011 iMac, and it has a Thunderbolt port and four USB 2 ports. I know that newer drives, external, are now USB 3. My problem is, short of going for a new machine, I'm looking at some sort of an upgrade. I currently have three external drives. Two are FireWire, and one is USB, for a total of 2.5 terabytes. One of these is being used for system backup. I'm considering a Thunderbolt dock. How far back in versions can I go with a dock, and will the FireWire and USB 2 drives gain any speed for data transfer through this method? I expect to upgrade to USB 3 external drives at some point in the near future. But at the moment, he says the drives I use are quite old. So, yeah, this is interesting, right? Because I'm sitting in front of a perhaps exactly the same model iMac. It's a minus a 27-inch 2011 iMac. And that's what I use to record the show. I do use a USB 3 drive with it, and I do use that by way of a Thunderbolt dock. And I've used many different Thunderbolt docks on this machine over the years. At the moment, I've got a CalDigit Thunderbolt dock on it. It's just a Thunderbolt 1 dock. That's all this machine supports. But it certainly can and does support USB 3. It's got an Ethernet port on it. It's got some audio ports. It's got, I believe this one has an eSATA and an HDMI port on it. I'm not looking at the back. My apologies. But yeah, this is sort of the beauty of Thunderbolt, right? Is that it is your expansion bus, and you can add capabilities to your computer that you simply didn't have before. Things that should be things that have to plug into the motherboard. But of course, since that's effectively what Thunderbolt does, then you get this out of it. So yeah, you can extend the life of a Mac quite a bit. In fact, I'll derail us for a second, then we can come back to this, John. But I posted a thing on the Mac Observer Twitter account last week asking people to tell us if their Mac was a year old or less, 2 to 3 years old, their desktop Mac. I did the same thing this morning with laptops. A year old or less, 2 to 3 years old, 4 to 6 years old, or older than 7. 64% of the people replying were more than 4 years old. Which is very interesting. Like these are, and I asked about daily driver, like not what's the oldest machine you have that you turn on sometimes. Like this is what's the machine that you use every day. How old is it? 64% of the people are using something 4 years old or older on a desktop. And it looks from it, even though it just started today, I think the same is going to be true, perhaps a little bit lower, 58, 59, 60% using a machine that's 4 years or older. And like 20% using a machine that's 20 years, that's 7 years older, older, which is huge. And this is part of the beauty of that is Thunderbolt makes these things expandable and upgradable in that sense. So, yeah, good, John.
I'm with you, man. Hey, you know, I got my MacBook Pro 2012, mid-2012, which in my humble opinion was the last of the great MacBook Pros.
That's right. Is that a Retina screen or no?
This was the last machine. So I thought very carefully when I got this.
Right.
But no, this is the last machine where all of I would consider the major components, including which I'll consider the battery, the drive, and the RAM, were all user serviceable.
Right.
Once they got past this one, the one following it, which was the Retina, that's when they started making the machine less user serviceable.
Right, right. Yeah.
And it's still my daily driver. It's still, you know, it's got a quad core i7, you know, plenty of RAM. I have, the only thing that it does that's weird is if I start it up sometimes, Hardware Growler reports thrashing of the HD, the FaceTime camera, because it'll say connect, disconnect, connect, disconnect. And while it's having this discussion with the camera, anything else that's USB, such as the keyboard, I don't have access. So this is something that's been happening more and more. I don't know if I should disconnect the FaceTime camera or whatever, but it's having a problem. It traumatizes the USB bus for several seconds. Then once the machine is woken up, then it, you know, everything's great for the most part.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah, it's fascinating, man. It's fascinating.
And then, you know, my desktop is, the 2014 Mini, which maybe someday some people speculate they may actually update the Mini. I don't know. I think it'd be nice because I still think it's a nice machine for the money.
Yeah, we had an interesting conversation on TMO's Daily Observations today, John Martellaro, Jeff, and I, about what that looks like. And it's worth listening to because John Martellaro also has some great thoughts on this. But I think the what really seems to be the gist is what do consumers see as the defining characteristics of a quote unquote serious desktop machine, and I think that's what Apple's going for with what will be the 2019 Mac Pro. So I don't know, it's interesting. Yeah, right, onward and upward. Sort of, unless you're using an old machine. You know, I used an 11-year-old. I used an 11-year-old iMac last week. Was it last week when my heat was out? Whatever it was, last week or week before when my heat was out, I used an 11-year-old iMac to prep the show, and it worked swimmingly. It's fine. So it's just interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So just double checking with our pal Mac Tracker, but yes. Yeah, so my machine was the last revision of the Mac Mini.
Okay, right.
So it'd be nice if they bumped it up. But, you know, honestly, I got to say, Dave, if I had to do it again, I think I'd probably get an iMac.
That has always been my my thing. Many times I have thought, all right, I need a new Mac for, you know, this person or that purpose or whatever. It's like, yeah, I guess it's desktop Mac. Doesn't need to be a laptop. Great. Don't need to pay the laptop tax. Awesome. Probably get a Mac Mini. Then I start pricing. And it's like, whoa, for like $50 more. It always seems like it's like, but $50 to $100. It's like, wow, I could get an iMac. Comes with a screen. It's a little bit faster. Yeah, I'm gonna go do that. That's what's happened to me every time. So,
yeah, I just appreciated the spirit of the Mac Mini, which is like
totally,
you know, number one. It's you know, fairly inexpensive in the line of Macs, and I can hook up my own keyboard and screen and peripherals and stuff.
Yep.
But at this point now, I think the screen on the iMac is wonderful. So, why not go for that? Just make sure you get enough RAM and screen to serve your needs for foreseeable future.
Well, I mean, I've got two screens on this iMac and same downstairs. I mean, there's the built-in 27, and then I've got another 27 sitting next to it.
Right. No, yeah, you can plug another, you can extend the screenage.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it works. I mean, that works great. I've always had that, or not always, but for a long time. Once you get used to a desktop scenario with multiple screens, you don't go back. It's very difficult. you just get used to having all that real estate. And believe it or not, I've only had it here in the podcast studio for a couple of months. And already it's like, I can't imagine going back and like cramming everything in on one screen and having to. The nicest part is being able to have just multiple windows up at a glance and not letting things get buried and that sort of thing. So at least for me. Hey, I want to take a minute, John, and I want to talk about our sponsor for this episode, which is Barebones. As I mentioned in the intro, Barebones is up to version 12.1. And BBEdit 12.1, when I say Barebones is up to 12.1, I of course mean BBEdit, their flagship product, their text editor. BBEdit, the cool part is you can just download a copy and use it. You don't have to pay for it if you don't need all of its features. And quite frankly, for many of you, you probably do fine with just the free version, which is, of course, sort of the point. They want you to be using it. And then if your needs go beyond the sort of Actually, it's very full featured set of features. But if they go beyond that, then of course, you'll upgrade because you know how to use it and you love it. But it's really, really cool. And version 12 brings some very important things to BBEdit. It is 64-bit native, which is cool. It has touch bar support. It has a dark theme support. When you're using a dark color scheme, BBEdit's colors now match, and the chrome matches, so it really kind of blends in and doesn't burn out your eyes when you're bouncing around from other dark windows. This one just stays that way. Very, very cool stuff there. BBEdit allows you to read and save files to your FTP or SFTP sites. The UI for that changed for the better in 12. I mean, a huge way. And so you got to check that out too. Very, very cool stuff. The thing is, I use BBEdit every day. I'm always just putting text into it. A lot of times I'm using it to count words or to find text or even just to sanitize text. When I'm trying to copy something from a web page into either an email or maybe an article that we're doing, I'll copy it. And if I just paste it directly, it inherits all the formatting and everything. I paste it into BBEdit. By its nature, BBEdit just doesn't inherit any of that. And then I can sort of get it looking the way I want, copy it, paste it into whatever app I'm using, and life is good. So you got to check this out. Go to barebones.com and check out BBEdit. Download your free copy. You get all the features for 30 days, and then you're limited to the free feature set past that. But again, for many of you, that's going to be enough. Our thanks to Barebones for sponsoring this episode. All right, Mr. Braun, let's move on to Bill, because Bill calls us out on something that we didn't get quite right in the last episode, but I've got an answer for you, Bill. So Bill says in 703, I was listening to Emma while jogging this morning, couldn't wait to get home to try the keyboard shortcut to switch to a window that is minimized in my dock. The inability to bring up such a window has frustrated me for the past 10 years that I've been on a Mac after many, many years on a Windows system. However, my bubble was burst in disappointment yet again as the supposed solution of command backtick simply doesn't work on either my iMac or my MacBook Pro. Like your listener, I've always used Command Tab to switch between applications and have long used Command Backtick to switch between windows of the same app, so long as all of the windows are open and not minimized. However, nothing I've found will pull up a window minimized on the dock except clicking on it manually. To test the solution, and he goes through his test, and he is absolutely right. So any window that is minimized will be skipped when you command backtick through your active windows. And that's either as you want it or it's frustrating, depending on what you want. There's good news, though. I found a way to do it, John. The solution is Keyboard Maestro. Keyboard Maestro is, I couldn't imagine running a Mac without this app now either. It automates a lot of things. I use it for my multiple clipboards. And you can use it. It has a window switcher and an app switcher that you can invoke with a keystroke. By default on my system, the window switcher was bound to control tab. And it did indeed switch through windows that were minimized and brings them right up. So you can blast right through that wall. You can also map Keyboard Maestro's window switcher to Command Backtick and have it take over instead of using Apple's. So there you go. There's the magic answer. And hopefully that'll do it. So there you go. Yeah. So when we answered last week, we were wrong. We got caught, but now we're uncaught or we've saved ourselves. So there you go. Do you use Keyboard Maestro yet, John?
Nope.
It's one of those things that once you start, it's hard to go back. Like, I feel like the future of automation on the Mac is in Keyboard Maestro's hands. And part of me would hope that Apple would acquire it just to have it in house. And maybe they will. Maybe they've tried and Peter said no. I don't know. But Like it would be bad to be running a Mac today, I think, where you needed to do automation if you couldn't use Keyboard Maestro. So, like, there you go.
Yeah, I just have such mad keyboard skills that there's no need.
Yeah, it's not, you know, that's perhaps the issue with Keyboard Maestro is they've got a PR issue with their name because it's not just keyboard stuff. It's doing all kinds of different macros. But yes, it's linked to the keyboard, but it's not that it's making your, it can do like keyboard shortcuts and stuff like Text Expander in a way, but it's really meant, it's a super powerful macro engine that can be triggered with keystrokes. But it's the macro engine that's the real power of Keyboard Maestro, not the fact that you can trigger it with your keyboard, if that makes sense. So,
no, I get it. Yeah. And I think another piece of software that's probably like that, I don't know if you use it, but Hazel is another one. It's like,
totally.
Well, what the heck is, what does it even mean,
right.
Hazel?
Right, right.
And I know a lot of people that that just can't live without it because it does a wide array of nice automated tasks on your Mac.
Exactly. I just set up two new Hazel rules on this computer today. I use it for our audio files, right? I save our podcast audio files to the local hard drive or the local SSD here. But I don't want to delete them, but I also can't like just leave them there because it'll fill up the SSD pretty quick. So it was actually Allison Sheridan that said, aren't you running Hazel? Couldn't you just like automate that and have it move those files every 2 weeks? It's like, oh yeah, duh. So that's what I do. And then today I added two more to grab some images and things that I create sort of routinely and wind up sitting on my desktop folder. It's like, yeah, nope, take these and go put them over there and then remove them from the drive. So it's, yeah, Hazel, Keyboard Maestro. These are the things that automate the stuff that I do on my Mac. Do you use Hazel, John, or no?
Nope.
Oh, interesting. It can really be helpful.
I know. I'm sure. Mm. I may revisit it at a point. If nothing else, I got to appreciate the name of the company, which is Noodlesoft.
Right.
Who doesn't love noodles?
Everybody. I like noodles. Yeah. It's good. It's okay not to, but I love them. All right. Let's go to Chris here, because I think we have the opportunity to kind of talk about something that happens to all of us with the troubleshooting process from time to time. Chris says, recently my Mac mid-2012 13-inch non-Retina i7 stopped recognizing the internal SSD, which is an aftermarket OCZ 480 gig SSD. He says, I get a white screen for a very long time, then the question mark folder icon blinking. I tried zapping the PRAM. I tried resetting the SMC. Didn't change anything. Oddly, if I put the drive in an external USB 3 enclosure, it recognizes it and boots without issue, although it's a lot slower than when the drive is internal. The SSD also works in other systems in the USB enclosure. I haven't tried connecting it to an internal SATA bus since that's inconvenient and doesn't seem likely to not work. Additionally, the SSD is covered by warranty and I have suitable backups. It is also recognized and booted from a spinning disk I connected internally. What did I change that could have caused this? I have been working on another machine more frequently and shut this one down for a few days. This is very rare for it. I usually use it for weeks, powered on, sleeping with the occasional restart. Also, probably not relevant, but I was at a higher altitude when I shut it down versus my home at about sea level where I am now. Is there anything else I should try before submitting a warranty claim to OCZ? The internet recovery wants to install Lion. I'd rather install High Sierra from the start. Is there any way to change or update this? Internet recovery, I don't think so. No, but you can go into recovery mode and do the current OS. But anyway, back to this other thing. This is weird. I get that. I'm thinking when you say it also recognized and booted from a spinning disk that I connected internally, that is your MacBook that recognized that disk. I feel like I can't imagine that this is a problem with that SSD. I mean, and that's the thing is you've tested that SSD. It works. It seems like there might be something wrong with the bus in that computer. Is it not like it's when the drive's seated in there, maybe it can't get the connector isn't quite right on the drive. Okay. I feel like we're missing something obvious about it only doesn't work in one place. And I don't think it's the drive. What do you think, John?
You know, I recall us having people writing in indicating when they had issues with a drive in their machine. It yep. could be, as you indicated, the SATA cable.
Right, right.
I know there was a very specific case in the past where the SATA cable wasn't quite SATA 3 compatible in some of the older units.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yes. Yeah.
So, but my guess would be, isolating it. That's a place I'd look. Now, it may not be easy to get. Well, no, it may not be too hard to get to that. Well, wait, what's he saying? No, actually, that's the same machine that I have.
Duh. Yeah.
Mid-2012. Well, mine's a 15-inch, but his is a 13. But it could be a failing or flaky SATA cable in there. So
it could be. So the question then would be, why did it work beforehand and what stopped it? Obviously, resetting the SMC does not fix this problem. I wonder if resetting the SMC caused this problem. I think it could very well be this SATA 3 thing. Maybe for some reason, the SMC, the whatever it is that decides how to talk to the drive was stuck in SATA 2 mode, and so it wasn't trying to negotiate this SATA 3 connection. But with the machine being off for 4 days, maybe the SMC got reset just by nature of the machine being off for as long as it was. And now you're in the scenario where it's trying to negotiate this connection that it can't. But yeah, I forgot about that cable issue where you can get a replacement cable, right?
Yeah, I think probably iFixit would be the place to go.
Yeah.
I bought a lot of other parts from them.
What's this? So,
cables, like everything else in life, eventually fail, right?
Well, yeah, but I think this one, wasn't it this one that, like, the cable was just not capable of doing it. I don't even think it was
right.
I mean, it was something about the cable that just wouldn't let it do SATA 3, but in either case, yeah, that I feel like that's where I would look first is at that. You've got a warranty on the drive, you've got backups. If you've got the time, it's not gonna, it's only gonna waste time to have them replace the drive, but I don't think that's gonna solve the problem. But it's a weird one, I see why you would jump to the drive, but I don't think the drive's the issue. I mean, I think you've ruled that out. So, Yeah. On the funny drives with funny messages doing funny things, front, we have Bill, who says recently, in the last week or so, one of my three external drives has started generating disk not ejected properly messages. I can't think of any settings I changed in this time frame. They appear to be occurring while the screen is turned off. I tried changing my system preferences energy saver setting for hard disk sleep from not checked to checked. Same symptom happens. Overnight, there can be 15 to 20 of these messages generated when I come back to the computer the next morning. It's a 5K Retina iMac from late 2015, 32 gigs of RAM, three external USB drives, each with two volumes, USB 3 drives. How do I stop these messages and the behavior that causes them? I've seen this. I see this occasionally on my computer, John. I run full time with an external drive connected where I keep my photos library and some other things. So this is, if anything interrupts that connection, I hear about it. And this happens, maybe a couple times a month. But it stopped happening after I pulled the cable out and plugged it back in and kind of positioned the drive to where the cable is not being stressed at all. And that did it. Like, it has a knock on simulated wood grain or something here. But it has not recurred since then. So I would think, especially since you haven't changed anything and you haven't done anything to the drive, I think we're either looking at yet another bad cable, or the controller on the drive, or maybe the drive itself is beginning to fail and you're seeing it take itself offline and come back. And it's not the drive that's issuing these error messages. It's macOS. I think you realize that, but just for everybody listening, it's macOS that generates these messages saying, hey, that drive was connected. It wasn't ejected, but it went offline and now it's back. So that's macOS saying, I'm not happy about you taking that drive away from me without ejecting it first. That's essentially the error message. And of course, you're not taking it away, but it is going away. I would, if you've got three drives, I would reposition this one in the chain and see how that works. And perhaps if you've got a different cable that you can try on this drive, I would try that too. Thoughts, my friend?
I concur, because I actually recently had an enclosure.
Yep.
That would do pretty much the same thing. Mm. The cable, I think it was the cable. The cable just wasn't quality or defective or had a short or something, as Brother Jay in our chat room suggested.
Yep.
So, get another cable, get another enclosure, and I'm betting this will go away.
But yeah,
I don't think it's a drive problem. I think it's either an enclosure problem or a USB cable problem.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm curious if you see this happen during the day when you're working on it. Because if not, then maybe there's a sleep issue with the drive itself. I mean, which seemed like the path you were heading down. Or maybe another drive in the chain or another device in the chain isn't dealing with wakes from sleep properly. I don't know, but
go ahead. Another USB port.
Oh yeah, that could be too. Yeah,
I mean, USB ports kind of flake out sometimes.
Yeah, I would reset the SMC on this Mac as well. That seems to be the theme of this episode. But resetting the SMC, whenever there's a weird hardware problem, that's the first thing you do, right? Because when it's hardware but not hardware, it's the SMC. And it can certainly lead you down the path of believing you have a hardware problem. But if this is truly not happening during the day when the machine's in use and is only happening overnight, then that starts to make me feel like this might be not a drive or cable issue, that the Mac just isn't sending the right signal to the drive to make it do the right thing so that it's there when the system wakes up. It's worth trying, especially if it's isolated to never happening when the machine's awake. Like, if it's a cable problem, you're going to see that error, you know, at all times, not just when the machine's asleep or unattended. Right? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Hey, in our pre-show chat today, John, I want to goad you on here, because we were talking about Bluetooth. And you had some strong words about what Bluetooth is. Do you remember what you said?
I think it's a hot mess.
Yeah,
is that what I said?
That's what you said. Yeah. So why do you say that? I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you. I'm just trying to.
It's just, we've gotten so many questions about, you know, especially when you get in the scope of multiple devices and priorities, and I just don't think Bluetooth was really very well thought out. I mean, the intent was to have a low cost, low bandwidth,
low battery
channel
usage
for you to talk to things.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, we have, you know, of course, now Bluetooth LE, low energy. So I get the intent of it, but it's just that the number of times that we've heard people have to wrestle with it to get it to do what they want, again, especially with multiple devices. I mean, you don't have this problem with Wi-Fi. You can, you know, load as many people as you want within reason. on a Wi-Fi access point and everything's fine. But we just keep getting questions that, you know, it doesn't talk to CarPlay and it doesn't, you know, connect to this and the audio quality stinks. And the, I mean, they've improved it, but still it's, I mean, what are they at now? Is it 4.0, I think?
Yeah, well, 4.2, which is the 4.2. low energy stuff. But Bluetooth 5 has been announced, and John, it's going to solve all the problems. Just like Bluetooth 4 was going to. Yeah. Yeah, it's disagree.
It's 2.4 gigahertz, you know, just like Wi-Fi or certain flavors of Wi-Fi. So it's, you know, it's a, you know, 2.4 gigahertz spread spectrum RF protocol. But there's just, it just saddens me that people have to keep wrestling with it to get it to do what they want. Whereas I don't see it as the case with Wi-Fi and other wireless protocols.
Yeah,
so that's just my take.
No, I think the interesting part about Bluetooth is how little control we users have over it, right? Like with Wi-Fi, you go into the router, you can go nuts, like changing settings, and you can actually create yourself a hot mess if you really want. Whereas Bluetooth, it's all peer-to-peer, plug and play, you know, zero configuration is really the buzzword I was looking for there, where it's just like, oh yeah, it just works. Don't worry about it. It just works. Low bandwidth, right? That's presumably the reason for no CarPlay, but you know, we do. We always have problems getting Bluetooth things to pair. And you said something interesting in the pre-show that if Steve Jobs was still around, like Bluetooth is a thing that he would attack. And what's interesting is how Apple, without obviously Steve Jobs, has been dealing with Bluetooth, because things like the AirPods work really well and really reliably, like scarily so. My kids just got AirPods, right? They each got a pair, and within, you know, seconds of opening the box, their AirPods were paired with their phone. Because what happens is you open the AirPods case, which powers it up and sends out the Bluetooth signal, and your iPhone's like, hey, do you want to pair with these AirPods? And you say, yeah. And then that's it. Like, you don't have to go through the normal pairing process or any of that. Well, I was at CES. I talked to a little birdie who told me how Apple is doing this. And what they're doing is they're putting the MAC addresses of every Bluetooth device from Apple, Mac, iPhone, iPad, in a database and auto pairing the AirPods with them. So because Bluetooth still requires like both devices to have each other's MAC addresses, like you have to go through that Bluetooth thing. But that W1 chip sort of skirts around this by just populating all those things in there. And then it's like, yeah, okay, no problem. Like we got you. It's, you know, it's prepared is what it is. And that's really interesting. I mean, it's a terrible workaround. It's terrible that workaround has to exist in order to improve the Bluetooth experience. And yet that's exactly the workaround that does exist, because you don't have to put it in pairing mode. It just is like, hey, it's all good. And even once you've paired them with a phone, like if I open my kid's AirPods near my phone, I just flip it open. It'll offer it to be like, hey, you want to pair with this phone? It's like, whoa, no, but thanks. I appreciate the offer. And they just work. So Apple has been getting creative with it. It's not a long-term solution. It's certainly not an industry-wide solution that they've come up with, but it works for the AirPods. But I think that highlights how imperfect and broken Bluetooth actually is, to me.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And if you want to explore the brokenness of it, I have two suggestions.
Okay.
So one, again, from our distinguished brother Jay in the chat room, there's something called Bluetooth Explorer that is part of the optional additional tools for Xcode. But I found another tool called Light Blue from Punch Through.
You've mentioned this before. Yeah.
Yes. And they've so between the two of them, I think the Bluetooth Explorer from Xcode is a bit dated.
Okay.
But Light Blue is a, you know, Punch Through. I guess they do Bluetooth consulting and development and stuff like that. It's a nice tool, and I've used it when I've had to debug Bluetooth problems. You know, shows all the devices near you, and you can dig in and get all of the details and stuff like that. So,
Cool. Yeah. I don't disagree with you. It's a hot mess. I mean, it is so, and perhaps this is the problem, because it's so crucial to the way I use my devices right now, right? Without a headphone jack, like, on my phone, I use AirPods when I just want to listen casually, or I want to talk on the phone, right? So that has to be Bluetooth. I mean, I could get a plug-in thing, but that's, you know, remembering the dongle and all that. It's just Bluetooth, even at its hot mess level, is still more convenient than that, in my opinion. When I want to come up and play my drums, I have one of those. It's an old thing, but I don't know if it's available, but there are things like it. It was called the Smart Bean from a company called Antec. And what it is, it's a Bluetooth receiver with a headphone jack on it. So you pair it with your phone, then I can plug in whatever headphones I want. And I just clip the little Smart Bean on my, you know, on my shirt or whatever. And then I can play my drums along with music that I can run from my phone, but I don't have to run a cable there. It's just Bluetooth. And, you know, I do the same thing when I'm traveling. I bring a Bluetooth speaker with me at home. Obviously I have Sonos, so that's not Bluetooth, and it's reliable. But it's always a little bit janky, other than with AirPods. It's always a little bit janky, even in my car, which is, I use Bluetooth in the car for many things. It pairs with my radar detector from Escort. It pairs with my car itself for both phone calls and music, right? I mean, Bluetooth is a major part of my life with my iPhone. But other than the AirPods, every single one of those interactions I just described to you is janky. That sucks.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, the only thing, honestly, I use Bluetooth for, Dave, is I don't really use it for any audio. The only thing I use it for is to enable handoff.
Sure. Yeah, sure. The Smart Bean's available on Amazon, by the way. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. I didn't realize it was still a thing.
But I have no reason to use Bluetooth other than that macOS and iOS rely on it to talk to each other.
Sure. But you might find reason to use Bluetooth. I mean,
the thing is, all my audio, Dave, all of my audio, whether it be AirPlay or the Heos, Denon Heos that I have, are all over Wi-Fi.
That's Wi-Fi, and, sure.
And they work fine. I've never had any sort of audio streaming issue with any of those devices, because they're all on Wi-Fi.
Because it's Wi-Fi, sure. Yeah. So, for most people, I think it's fair to say that Bluetooth is probably an important part of their iPhone life.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
But yeah, and it's frustrating seeing it not just be janky enough that people are always like, just give me the cable and I'll plug it in, or what, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be that way. But it,
yeah, but hey, like you said, 5 is coming out. They'll probably get it right eventually.
Oh, yeah. No problem. Yeah. Good stuff. Where does that put us here? John, I think that puts us at the end here. That's just how it's got to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how it's going to be. We got a lot of questions left, but that's okay, because you know what? I saw on the schedule we're doing another one of these next week, so we can answer some of the questions then.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, outstanding.
Yeah. Hey, if you want to join the live stream and join in the chat room with us and all that stuff, we do this, and generally we do this at 5. We meet at 5:15 p.m. Eastern time on Mondays these days. That's our time slot. It does sometimes change. We always publish that to a calendar at macgeekgab.com/calendar. You can subscribe there if you want. So just go to that link and it'll offer to subscribe on your phone or on your Mac, however you do it. And then you join us at macgeekgab.com/stream, and we have a blast in the chat room, and it's actually a whole lot of fun. So we would love to have you here. But in the meantime, we need to fill up the queue. It already is kind of full, as I said, but we're going to fill it up more from you. So feedback at macgeekgab.com is how you're going to get your questions to us.
Yeah, I'm going to have to wag my finger at you, because I really think people should send an email to feedback at MacGeekGab.com, Dave.
Yeah, or feedback at MacGeekGab.com also works.
Well, all right.
In addition to that, all three of those, the fourth option, if you are a premium contributor / subscriber, premium at MacGeekGab.com is what you can do. So so that gives you lots of ways to get us, and we'll leave it at that because we told you about the chat room. We told you about this. It's all good. We don't want to overload. There's options we'd love to see in the chat room. It's a lot of fun. We stream the audio, of course, and we have the back channel happening there. So it's interesting. It's a little bit crazy because we're, you know, doing this and managing the agenda and answering your questions and then, you know, occasionally like just paying attention to the chat room. But it's great because it allows us to get real-time feedback while we're doing the episode. We don't have to wait a week. Usually we don't have to wait a week to offer some corrections. This week we did, but you know, things happen.
Yeah. So, and after all these years, both my esteemed colleague and I have managed to manage our ADD so we can kind of pay attention to all these things at once.
Not really. Yeah, not really. No, not really. I want to thank Cashfly at CACHEFLY.com for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. I want to thank all of our great sponsors, of course, Barebone Software with BB Edit, Smile at smilesoftware.com, Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com, RoboForm at RoboForm.com. We've got some more coming that I can't wait to tell you about. I hope you all have a great week. I hope you all have a great time this week. I hope none of you, not a single, in fact, for all of you, what I hope is that you don't get caught.
Made up.